The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It will be very interesting to compare their tenures side by side to kind of figure out how much is this administration overall versus a particular secretary. On the one hand, Pompeo's reportedly much better relationship with the president will be an advantage overall for the department. On the other hand, I think one of the critical roles of the department is precisely in contributing a unique perspective in interagency discussions that is deeply informed by regional knowledge, by understandings of international law institutions and framework. You know, I only hope that in switching hats, Mike Pompeo will also sort of internalize his role as the champion of a department that has certain equities in working with our partners, fostering alliances to really leverage the tremendous capabilities that we have, and not to, by being in the department, sort of substitute views of other agencies for the views of the State Department.
I'm Scott Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for March 31st, 2018. Last week, I sat down with Shemin Kightner, the Alfred and Hannah Fromm Professor of International Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. Earlier this year, Shemin wrapped up a 15-month stint as the Counselor for International Law at the State Department, a position she held from the last months of the Obama administration through most of the first year of the Trump administration. She joined me to talk about what it was like to work at the State Department during such an eventful period, and to share her unique perspective on what the future may hold for the department with Rex Tillerson's departure. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 296, Shemin Kightner on the State Department pre and post-Rexit. Shemin Kightner, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Glad to be here, Scott.
In December, you finished up a 15-month stint as Counselor on International Law at the State Department. Give us a little background on that position and the sorts of responsibilities you had when you were in that capacity.
You know, it's a fascinating role that's been around since the mid-1960s. The folks in the legal advisor's office at the State Department thought that it would be useful to have an academic or other sort of outside expert spend time fully integrated into the department as a way, I think, both of providing an opportunity for outside experts to get a sense of the office's work and the issues that they grapple with on a daily basis, and also to give folks in the department a really sort of an in-house sounding board who may have, you know, a little bit less of the institutional history and background, but, you know, greater kind of outside perspective that they can bring to the department's work. So I was very fortunate, you know, about 2 years ago to be approached with the possibility of jumping into that role. And it's something that I think, you know, has really become a very critical part of the day-to-day operations of the legal advisor's office.
So give us a sense day-to-day, you know, what would your schedule look like? Would it be filled with meetings? Are you writing briefs? What are your kind of day-to-day responsibilities like?
Well, I think it depends from counselor to counselor. I mean, the nice thing is, you know, you're sitting in the front office with the legal advisor and the deputies basically at their disposal to work on whatever issues they feel are most pressing and could most benefit from both an additional pair of eyes and someone to help play a coordinating role. So in recent years, certainly this is true of my experience, the counselor has had a pretty big role in the office's litigation portfolio. That's a portfolio that has been quite important, but particularly in recent years, as you know, the U.S. government is involved in a lot of litigation in U.S. courts and also litigation overseas. The Office of Foreign Litigation and the Justice Department, of course, handles our overseas cases in other countries' courts, but the State Department handles cases in international tribunals. And we also coordinate very closely with the Justice Department when the U.S. government is taking positions in U.S. courts that have foreign relations implications. So that coordinating role is something that the counselor in recent years, I think, has really been able to help with. I have a background in litigation. Some of my immediate predecessors had very strong litigation backgrounds. And the task of coordinating positions both within the building among different bureaus in the State Department and then in the interagency more broadly is something that we take very seriously because the U.S. executive branch does try to assess various components of the U.S. interest in these different cases and come up with a position that's both legally defensible and also in our long-term policy interest.
What about your background prepared you to be counselor? What set you on the path to become an expert in international law that has an interest in working at the State Department?
I have an international background. I was actually born in Canada, but grew up in both Canada and the U.S., and then went to university in the U.S. and then grad school in the U.K. And I have always been interested in questions of national identity, of borders, and then from that, law across borders. And so after I got my JD and clerked for a year, actually up at the Canadian Supreme Court, came back to the U.S. and settled here in the Bay Area, where I'm talking to you from now, and both taught and practiced civil litigation in U.S. courts, but with a real keen and enduring interest in international affairs. And the graduate work that I did in U.K. was actually a PhD in international relations. So my education certainly, you know, prepared me for this role. But as I mentioned earlier, I think that this is a job that is much more than just sort of abstract theoretical interest and importance. And so, you know, my litigation background also was really critical and was one of the kind of key qualifications for the job, because the role of the legal advisor is really to bring insights from kind of the more abstract and academic discipline of international law to the day-to-day workings of our government, both internally, as I said, vis-a-vis other departments and in terms of our domestic legal system, but also internationally in sort of the fabric of all of our international interactions is really permeated and structured by international legal rules. And so I've been teaching about those rules and writing about them for a decade or so, and was really, you know, excited at the opportunity to put that into practice. So I guess to give a better answer to your earlier question about the day-to-day, what that meant was indeed a lot of meetings, a lot of time over at DOJ, a lot of working with my colleagues at the State Department, both on research, but then also briefing, writing memos on particular legal topics, and really working collaboratively to try to figure out what the parameters were for any course of action that the United States might wish to take, and also any position that we might advance in a U.S. court.
So you started as counselor in September 2016. And obviously at that point, the 2016 presidential elections were only 2 months away. You know, what role did the elections play in your decision to take the job? And what were your expectations going into the job, given the big change that might be just around the corner?
You know, as I mentioned, that the counselor is someone who kind of comes in from the outside because of the long tradition of this role. I think folks in the office really appreciate having someone in that position. So when my predecessor left in June 2016, the then legal advisor, Brian Egan, who himself had just come in at the beginning of 2016, I think really, you know, was anxious to get someone up and running in that role. You know, those of us who aren't family members of the president do actually need to go through the security clearance process before we're allowed to start our jobs. And so that process took a few months, which, as I understand it, was actually, you know, much faster than it can take for lots of folks who are entering into government positions that require security clearances. So as you said, when I ultimately started, it was about September. And for me, I think that certainly meant that I was coming in knowing that there would be most likely a change in legal advisor with the transition in administrations, whether or not it was a same party or different party transition. And I hoped, and ultimately I think this, you know, came to pass, that I would, you know, help to provide some additional stability in our front office during that transition by virtue of being another civil servant. The counselor typically is not a political role. It is a temporary civil service position, but it is one that really is outside of politics and is designed, as I said, to sort of bring in this more kind of outside expert perspective. And so I came in, you know, just like anyone else who was coming into a civil service position kind of late in the Obama administration, knowing that there would probably be a personnel change come January, and, you know, wanting to do the best work I could for as long as I could for the U.S. government, irrespective of party transitions.
You spent most of your tenure as counselor under Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. What was your experience with him as secretary? You know, there have been a lot of conversations about concerns about his management style or aspects of morale issues within the broader statement. I'd be curious about your experience.
Well, I think there's, you know, there's sort of two components to what it meant to serve in this administration. Of course, one, as you mentioned, is having served for the better part of a year with Secretary Tillerson. And all of us are still kind of processing not so much the fact of his departure, which I think a lot of people expected to happen sooner than it did, but the way in which it happened. And I think that connects to the bigger overarching theme of serving in this administration, which is our really, you know, utterly unpredictable president. And so I think the difficult thing for people in the civil service generally in this administration is that, you know, we've built up over the decades and in some cases even, you know, over a century, practices, understandings, ways of approaching questions collaboratively that, you know, to be sure, from administration to administration don't always work perfectly. And there's always room for adjustment and improvement. But on a process level, this administration really has been, you know, to my understanding and in conversation with others who've served for decades in their roles, unprecedented in terms of the way in which the process and input from different branches and from different people with expertise is just not being leveraged. And that happens at various points along the pipeline. So, you know, we can talk about the disconnect between what the president himself is sort of saying and tweeting and what his, you know, sort of closest cabinet level national security advisors are telling him. In terms of the State Department itself, I think my experience was very consistent with the excellent reporting that's been done. I mean, certainly I would say that there were times during the course of the past year where something would come out in the press and it would be, to my mind, sort of overly sensationalized and taken out of context. And so that was a little bit frustrating being on the inside. But I think there were some things that were very accurately reported, and that included the secretary's failure to do precisely what I just described, which is to take advantage of the expertise in the building to understand how he could, you know, make this tremendous organization work to serve the United States' foreign policy interests in a constructive way going forward. And so I think that was disappointing. And now that he's no longer there, I feel a little bit more comfortable talking in public about my personal disappointment in that regard, because I think it was really a missed opportunity that the welcome speech he gave when he first arrived on the job specifically said he was looking forward to going around the building, shaking everyone's hands. I mean, it was a pretty ambitious welcome statement, but with very little follow through in that respect. And I think that that is something that everyone regrets.
Now, insofar as Secretary Tillerson had a sort of signature initiative that was a major focus of his tenure as secretary, it was his redesign effort, although I think it's since been relabeled, his effort to reform and restructure the State Department. It started very ambitious. As we know, at the early parts of the administration, there was a lot of talk about completely restructuring how immigration is handled, how visas are handled, how foreign assistance is handled, but it's been pared down dramatically. But a lot of parts of it are still hanging around, including some pretty strict restrictions on hiring and promotions and rotations that have a pretty direct impact on State Department employees. What was the experience of you and your colleagues going through that redesign, and how did you see it affect State Department capabilities and morale?
Well, it's not clear to me, and still not clear to me, sort of how much has actually been implemented versus just a lot of discussion, a lot of things, you know, on the drawing board, so to speak. I think that on the one hand, as I understand it, the way that Secretary Tillerson engaged in that process was actually more participatory than some other agency heads. So I think that he is to be commended for that, although the way in which it was participatory, you know, using technology and bringing in, you know, an outside consulting company that didn't have previous government experience to engage employees in the, you know, somewhat dubious task of making word clouds and things like that was perhaps not the best use of time. But I think there was an attempt to make it participatory. I think, although perhaps understandable, the decision to freeze hiring while that was going on was really not the best thing to do. I understand on the one hand, the desire not to get people into positions that you're then going to either eliminate or reassign and so forth. But it meant that the secretary never actually was in charge of a fully staffed, fully operational, if you will, department. And I think that that meant that when we were sort of operating at way less than maximum capacity, the capability of the department to be a really effective, both the ability of the secretary to be an effective voice in our foreign policy, the ability of folks in the building in Foggy Bottom to be contributing to the formulation of that policy and the ability of folks out in the field in various countries to be implementing that policy was and remains extremely hindered. Of course, I'm talking about policy as if it's a unitary thing. And as I mentioned earlier, the additional complication in all of this, of course, is that, you know, the secretary alone cannot make, let alone implement, foreign policy. It is, you know, sort of a whole of government endeavor that involves close coordination with the Defense Department, of course, and through the White House. It involves coordinating closely with our representatives in the United Nations. And while the relationship between, I think, the Secretary of State and the ambassador to the UN is always somewhat fraught in terms of territoriality and agenda setting, I think we saw that that was certainly the case. You know, there was no love lost between Secretary Tillerson and Ambassador Haley, at least in their public communications, tended to make that pretty clear. So it's difficult, I think, in retrospect to know how much effect even sort of a fully operational, so to speak, State Department would have been in such a dysfunctional administration. And I think, again, in retrospect, and kind of giving the secretary the benefit of the doubt in terms of the policy coordination piece, you know, when you have a president who demands personal loyalty, who is so impulsive in so many ways, it is, I think, difficult to figure out how to maintain a voice at the cabinet level and to establish some sort of working relationship with the president while at the same time cultivating ties with and building up the capacity of a department that the president appears fundamentally to mistrust. That said, I think Secretary Tillerson would have done much better had he followed through on his initial commitment to really understand the department he was inheriting. I think the point to remember is that folks who go into the civil service, and I include myself in this group, even though it was a short period of time, do so because they are willing to transcend the confines of party politics in order to work for what they perceive as sort of the common good of the American people. And while that may sound trite, I think there's a really important underlying truth there, which is that folks who go into the civil service have chosen not to go into party politics or to work for someone who is of one political party or the other. They understand that there will be political transitions and transitions in administrations, and they're there to ensure the kind of continuity and expertise that's required in this day and age to run the government well. And I think that by not seeking input from the thousands of people who do that every day at the State Department, and by instead sort of creating kind of mini department up on the seventh floor where the secretary sits, stocked primarily with political appointees who did not have that deep experience, the secretary on the one hand may have created the appearance of buying in a little bit to this notion of, you know, it's us against them and, you know, we need to rally our political allies around us in the face of the deep state, so to speak. But I think that the difficulty is when it comes down to actually running the country and to actually doing what's in the country's long-term best interest, that approach is ultimately unsustainable.
One of the symptoms, if you will, of this kind of redesign effort has been a fair number of gaps in kind of the middle to senior to fairly senior levels of leadership at the State Department. There are very few assistant secretaries that have been confirmed, a number of missing undersecretaries. And the Office of Legal Advisor, of course, is no exception to that for most of your tenure. You didn't get a confirmed legal advisor until, I believe, shortly after your departure. Give us a sense of what it means for a State Department office to not have a confirmed leadership at that level.
You know, to be clear, the legal work of government goes on apace whether or not you've got political appointees. And so while there were certainly, you know, stories coming out in the press from the State Department of legions of employees sitting around twiddling their thumbs because they had no policy direction, I mean, that certainly wasn't true of the lawyers in the building. We were all extremely busy and, in fact, even more so because of the lack of political appointees. But the law only gets you so far. The lingo of the department essentially is, you know, you need what's called a policy steer. And that's what folks who are elected and then appointed by the elected administration are there to provide. Again, in the best scenario, even though political appointees, you know, often will disagree amongst themselves about the best way to achieve certain objectives. And that's where, you know, vigorous interagency discussion, debate is extremely important and in producing, you know, the best outcomes. The idea is that they are, you know, have defined certain objectives that they are, you know, seeking to implement. the absence of folks in the building meant that there were not people available on the policy side to provide direction in that regard. And so, you know, the expression of kind of a rudderless building, I think that came up at a number of points, is a characterization that certainly resonates with me. Again, as far as the legal work of the office is concerned, both vis-a-vis our work with interagency partners, our work with DOJ on cases that have deadlines that are not going to wait for a political appointee to come in, that proceeded apace with, I think, a sensitivity to the fact that absent a politically appointed legal advisor, we were not going to go out on a limb with any new positions, precisely because I think civil servants are very keenly aware of their role in advising on legally available arguments, advising on the context in which different decisions are made. For example, if you think about the different regional bureaus who are charged with really getting a deep understanding of the different regions in which the U.S. government operates, to sort of be able to lay out for their policy clients a good picture of the context in which decisions are being made. But at the end of the day, when there isn't someone there to actually make decision who has political legitimacy and authority, when all decisions are being funneled up to, as I mentioned before, sort of the seventh floor, in which the volume of paper that must have gone up there, again, in any administration is pretty unfathomable, but particularly when you don't have folks to whom you can delegate decisions or to whom you're willing to delegate decisions, you end up in a real bottleneck situation. And I think that that situation certainly did arise very early on. It was very hard to get decisions made in a timely manner. And that was extremely frustrating for folks who were trying to make sure that our operations proceeded as smoothly as possible in the circumstances. So I'm deeply worried still about the lack of senior people, either, you know, civil servants who are serving in, you know, managerial positions, who can, again, you know, maybe not go out on a limb and sort of forging new policies, but at least provide some direction and guidance to those who are working for them. And I think that the result of a vacuum like that is either that other departments kind of step in to fill the void, or that decisions are being made either late or not at all, or with insufficient input from folks who really know the subject matter area and can provide the necessary information in order to enable a good decision to be made, right? That, I think, continues. And, you know, I haven't been in the department now for a couple of months, but I'm very hopeful that maybe we can see some movement on that front. But at the same time, not entirely optimistic that the current disjunction that we seem to have between, you know, what the president is saying and doing, even what some of his senior political advisors have been counseling, means that it is very difficult for the United States to advance forceful positions on the world stage with any sort of coherence or any sort of systematic nature. And so that really does hobble our capability to pursue any policy, whatever that policy may be. Politics aside, you want to be able to implement coordinated strategies, and that's really difficult to do at this time.
Now, Secretary Tillerson, as I mentioned, his redesign effort, he pared down fairly severely toward the end of his tenure as secretary, which kind of leaves an open question. What is he going to be remembered for? What is going to be his legacy? What are your views on that? Do you have a sense of what you think Secretary Tillerson's legacy will be?
You know, I'm sitting here shaking my head, Scott. You know, you may have watched, he did an interview on 60 Minutes not long before he was fired. And I watched that interview with great interest, and with great interest for a couple of reasons. I mean, for one thing, I think, you know, he was not interested in the limelight. And I think, you know, to his detriment, tended to avoid interacting directly to a large extent with the media. And even, as I mentioned earlier, with a lot of people in his own building. So I think that my understanding is it seems that Steve Goldstein, when he came in, really was pushing the secretary to build more of a public presence, to communicate more, to communicate better. And I perceive the 60 Minutes interview as being sort of a part of that effort. And I think what folks got a sense of from that interview, which is something that I, having worked in the building for a year, had the opportunity to get a sense of earlier, was the secretary's really deep sense of duty and obligation. As he explained in that interview, his number had not come up in Vietnam. And he felt, having seen his close relatives go to fight in the war, that he had not yet made, notwithstanding his tremendous success in the private sector, the kind of contribution to the country that he felt he owed. Now, I know I can hear sort of the little violins playing in the background. If he really felt he owed that contribution, there's a lot of things he could have done when he was sitting on the seventh floor that he didn't do. But nonetheless, I do feel that he worked very hard in a very difficult situation with essentially an impossible boss. That said, precisely because of that, I think he really, you know, should have gotten to know the building better before he set out to change it. I think the mentality somehow that you're going to come in and kind of turn the ship around before you fully understand where it's going was, I just think, fundamentally misguided. And I'm as mystified as everyone else who's wondering, you know, how could someone who came in from the private sector have been so misguided in this effort? Isn't that the one thing that you would expect if you're bringing someone in from a large company? The only, you know, speculation I could engage in is that having, you know, risen up through the ranks in Exxon, he ended up taking for granted the deep knowledge and connections that he had there, somehow not realizing that when you essentially lateral into another organization, you need to build up that knowledge, you need to build up that goodwill before you can attempt to make systemic changes. So unfortunately, I fear that what he'll be remembered for are really his missteps in terms of not kind of sticking up for the department in the way that folks there hoped he would have. That said, you know, depending on, you know, assuming that Mike Pompeo is confirmed, which of course there's all indications are that he will be, it will be very interesting to compare their tenures side by side. In other words, to kind of figure out, you know, how much is this administration overall versus a particular secretary. And I think that on the one hand, you know, Pompeo's reportedly much better relationship with the president will be an advantage overall for the department in the sense of having a voice at the table. On the other hand, I think one of the critical roles of the department is precisely in contributing a unique perspective in interagency discussions that is deeply informed by regional knowledge, by understandings of international law institutions and frameworks, and how the United States can best pursue its interests within those frameworks. And in fact, even historically anyway, take a leading role in creating those frameworks. And, you know, I only hope that in switching hats, Mike Pompeo will also sort of internalize his role as, you know, the champion of a department that has certain equities that are ultimately, you know, U.S. government equities. Those are equities in, you know, working with our partners, fostering alliances, figuring out how to create systems internationally that, of course, serve U.S. interests. I mean, that's what our government is elected to do, whatever, you know, its political stripes, but to really leverage the tremendous capabilities that we have, notwithstanding their diminished capacity, and not to essentially, by being in the department, sort of substitute views of other agencies for the views of the State Department. So I really hope that he will internalize what it means to be the Secretary of State and why that is such a critical role in advancing U.S. interests.
Fair. Let's take one step back a little bit. I mean, thus far in the Trump administration, they've developed a kind of reputation, a deserved one in my view, I think in a lot of people's views, as being a little skeptical of a lot of international law and institutions. Of course, that was part of the president's rhetoric and the rhetoric of a lot of people around him, focusing on sovereignty. That's a big focus of his speech for the United Nations. And during his presidency and during the first year of his presidency, it was a focus of the national security strategy and other elements that he's presented. And early on, you know, we saw the Trump administration come forward with a draft executive order that would have barred multilateral treaties and other pretty dramatic measures, although those weren't implemented. But this was viewpoint. Obviously, some people may come into government and then adapt that viewpoint as they actually interact with international law and international institutions, see how they affect and can be used to help advance U.S. policy. Out of curiosity, how do you feel the Trump administration's views towards international law institutions have changed, if they have? How do you think they should change if they haven't?
It's interesting because I find myself thinking, well, who is the Trump administration, right? Because we've got the president on the one hand, who, as I said, I think, you know, continues to surprise even his closest advisors. And then we've got those who are trying to work for and with him. The notion as a general matter, that the United States can best pursue its interests unilaterally rather than in cooperation with other countries. The notion that we sort of tie our hands by entering into various international commitments and that that is somehow a disadvantage is not at all, of course, a new one. It's a strand of U.S. foreign policy thinking that resurfaces from time to time. And I think on a sort of case-by-case basis, one can certainly have informed debates about whether some sort of, and you mentioned multilateral treaties. So, you know, treaty framework is best designed to achieve goals that we think are in the United States' long-term interests or not. I think what is the most disturbing to me about at least the rhetoric that President Trump was elected on is precisely the things that so many Republican foreign policy experts were warning about. I mean, as you'll recall, there were a number of sort of open letters warning essentially about the threat to the national interest and national security that candidate Trump posed. And these were warnings issued by Republican foreign policy leaders of previous administrations, expressing concerns about precisely the kinds of things that you mentioned, that the perception that somehow alliances are antithetical to rather than essential to advancing the U.S. national interest, I think is something that just really was and remains quite frightening to those who have worked in this field for many years. It's hard, I think, to know going forward, you know, what the ultimate balance sheet will look like. I think on the one hand, a lot of the rhetoric is, at least my perception is, you know, sort of geared towards a certain domestic constituency that feels empowered by this kind of sovereigntist, anti-internationalist rhetoric. And again, that's nothing new. I think what may be new is the receptiveness to that kind of rhetoric, but the rhetoric itself is nothing new. Then the question is, so how much are we going to actually act on it? And I think that remains to be seen. I mean, the two agreements that have most been in the headlines, of course, are the Paris Climate Change Agreement and the Iran deal, as it's referred to, the JCPOA. And I think that the concern that I have in both cases is that those sort of domestic political appeal of, you know, kind of throwing those out the door has overshadowed any kind of reasonable discussion about what actually is in the U.S.'s long-term interest. So if I were persuaded that there were kind of rational cost-benefit analyses being undertaken that kind of pointed in a different policy direction, then obviously at this point, those discussions would have to take into account, you know, the reputation damage done to the United States if we essentially go back on our word, then, you know, I think elected representatives have certainly the authority to make different decisions than previous administrations. At the same time, obviously, you know, regime change in and of itself does not at all absolve us of our international commitments. I mean, no international commitments would work if that were the case. And so I think, again, the content of these agreements aside, you know, there's a really important credibility factor. And I think we're really eroding our credibility by even suggesting, you know, that we might walk away from something that we agreed to in a previous administration in anything other than the terms provided for in the agreement itself. So while, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement, I think, as many people pointed out, itself was really designed to catalyze various countries' voluntary efforts to reduce carbon emissions. Very sorry to see the United States retreating from a leadership position in that overall effort. The fact that we indicated our intent to withdraw in accordance with the agreement's terms at least shows that in some respects, we're still playing by the rules of the game. In terms of what's going to happen on Iran, that's something that, you know, a lot of people have been talking about, saying that now that Mike Pompeo is coming in, he's been extremely vocal in his disapproval of that arrangement. Again, my concern will be at the end of the day, you know, how the decisions are made, whose voices are listened to, who's at the table in those discussions. And what I really lack right now at the highest levels, and so I'm not talking about the State Department or even sort of the interagency process, which might surprise some, but is actually in certain areas kind of up and running again in some fairly reassuring ways. But I think, you know, the real problem as I perceive it is at the end of the day, you know, the president speaks for the country and, you know, his utter disregard, not only for international legal frameworks and norms of behavior, but also domestic, you know, legality in a lot of cases, whether it's ethics or respect for the judiciary or separation of powers, is really, I think, throwing into question a lot of the basic assumptions that we all had about governance and about how decisions are made by representatives of either party. So for me, I think one of the big takeaways of working in the civil service was, you know, I actually didn't know and still don't know whether many of my colleagues are, you know, registered Republicans or Democrats. It really was not about party politics at all, at least, it, you know, in the office I worked in. It was about what are the frameworks that we've already established? You know, what are the parameters in which our policy makers can operate? And the, you know, as the Bombshell podcast crew likes to say, you know, I think process is my Valentine too. And that's really where my biggest concerns are at the moment, are not so much in the area of substantive disagreements, although on a personal level, I may have those, but it is in the breakdown in process. And it's not entirely clear to me, at least with this president, how those are going to be rectified, or if they're going to be rectified during this administration, however many terms it may last.
So when he announced his decision to bring in Mike Pompeo as the new Secretary of State, President Trump noted that the JCPOA deadline was coming up in May. This is the deadline to renew sanctions waiver that's required by the JCPOA, one that he's indicated he's not willing to renew without seeing major changes. In that same month, we're also currently scheduled to have negotiations with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un directly between him and President Trump. And in that same month, the U.S. embassy in Israel is going to be relocating to Jerusalem, more than a year ahead of the original schedule that Secretary Tillerson announced. So these are three big trial by fires that Secretary Pompeo, if he's confirmed by them, will have to face, or if he's not, then Deputy Secretary Sullivan or whoever is feeling the capacity of the Secretary of State at that time will have to face. What should we be looking for in these incidents? What are good signs that things are going in a good direction? And what are worrisome signs from your perspective?
To my mind, the good signs would be anything that seems to indicate interagency coordination, sort of unified rollout of these various initiatives rather than ad hoc freelancing by, you know, whoever it may be. And unfortunately, what we seem to be seeing is a fair bit of freelancing. And the reason that that's troubling is precisely because of the interconnected nature of, you know, so many of the activities that the United States undertakes worldwide. So, for example, if we are talking to Russia about whatever's left of our bilateral relationship and how we can ensure that Russia stops testing the limits over and over again, whether it is in Syria or with the, you know, chemical attacks in the UK or vis-a-vis our own election systems, testing the limits of appropriate behavior in the sort of post-Cold War era, what other countries will tolerate. And it seems that at least at this point, other countries will tolerate quite a lot. At the same time as we have this sort of very inflamed rhetoric, both about North Korea on the one hand and Iran on the other, I think it's important for the administration to prioritize and to synchronize. And so I think to the extent that we see evidence of that happening, it means that hopefully those who do not have to answer immediately to a particular domestic political constituency are having a voice at the table, are taking the longer view as it is their institutional role to do, and trying to coordinate, you know, how best to leverage U.S. influence in the world and amidst these various different frameworks. I think the kind of single-minded focus on whether it's the embassy move or trying to play this kind of strange cat and mouse game with North Korea, while at the same time having essentially announced or telegraphed, you know, pretty since the beginning of the administration that the administration is sort of looking for any excuse to get out of the Iran deal, makes it much more difficult to essentially sort of look at the whole picture and figure out how best to maneuver going forward. And I think in order to do that, you need some willingness to engage with issues on more than just a superficial level, and more than a 5-second attention span. And those are things that are seriously lacking. And so then the question is, you know, will the president be willing to be guided by those who do dive into issues at a greater degree of depth and have more than a 5-second attention span? And I think, you know, in the first part of the administration, so I'd say sort of maybe from, you know, a year ago, right? So that the administration that first came in and dumped all these executive orders and was sort of, you know, came in with a bang, and everybody was scrambling to try to figure out what was going on. I think that that period settled down and we had a period of, you know, as has been referred to in the press, kind of the adults in the room having some degree of influence. I think some of these recent personnel changes, kind of rumored upcoming personnel changes, suggest that maybe the president doesn't feel like the adults in the room have been serving him, that he, or maybe doesn't appreciate the extent to which they have been serving him and now feels that he can do without them. So my concerns, or what I'd be looking out for, are indications, again, that decisions are being made in a coordinated and systematic way, whether or not I personally happen to agree that those decisions are in our long-term national security interest or not. And what would worry me the most, and what does worry me every day, are when indications come out that they are not being made that way. Now, I do think a note of caution is important. I mean, having been on the inside, so to speak, for a period of time, you know, I really credit journalists with doing a phenomenal job trying to piece together what's going on and give, you know, an account to the American public of how our government is working. That said, you know, there is a lot that is unknowable and that is easy to misinterpret from where we are all now sitting. So it may well be that more process is happening than is apparent on the outside. And I certainly can attest that both, you know, the political appointees I worked with and, of course, you know, the civil servants who are there are doing their very best to ensure that decisions are made in an informed and a deliberate manner. And that work is often invisible. And so, you know, that the one note of caution that I would urge is sometimes not to get too carried away with kind of how things appear in the moment, because there may be more there. But at the same time, I think that that shouldn't at all make us complacent. I think we really are in a political moment in which it is not business as usual. And although to a certain extent, I think those who voted for President Trump did so precisely because they didn't want business as usual, particularly when it comes to foreign relations and national security matters, you know, you can't do those things on the fly. And that, you know, is I think one of the things that frustrated Secretary Tillerson so much and led to the kind of the famous moron comment, at least as reported, the notion that, no, you can't, you know, set troop levels in Afghanistan the same way that you would go about renovating a high-end restaurant in New York. And it's ludicrous to even think that that would be any sort of appropriate analogy under any circumstances. So it's a very difficult situation that folks in government find themselves in. And what I'll be looking for is signs of thoughtful deliberation and, you know, hoping that we see as many of those as we can.
Well, Shuman, your time in government has ended. You're back in the beautiful Bay Area, far from uncharacteristically snowy Washington, D.C., as I speak. What is the next chapter in your career? And how is your time in the State Department going to influence your career path and your scholarship moving forward?
Well, that's exactly what I've been thinking about in the last couple of months, Scott, and I don't have an easy answer yet. I mean, I will say, for one thing, on a personal level, I just really appreciated and enjoyed so much working with the phenomenally dedicated, intelligent, hardworking folks in the legal advisor's office. And the other thing that was interesting to me, of course, is to see the ways in which legal scholarship did and didn't inform policy debates within government. And so I think there's, you know, a certain type of scholarship that is, you know, extremely important and interesting, but probably at too high a level of abstraction to really be useful to those who are, say, litigating cases or, you know, making decisions kind of on a day-to-day basis about how to articulate certain positions. At the same time, some of the work that I have done and I think will continue to do is very historically focused. And that type of work, at least on the sort of litigation side of things, I think still is quite interesting, because seeing where different doctrines came from, you know, how they've evolved over the years, I think it is a really interesting endeavor and does continue to inform kind of how legal arguments are framed in U.S. courts today.
Now, a lot of people who read Lawfare regularly, a lot of people who listen to the Lawfare podcast are people who are very serious about public service. They care about national security policy. They care about government and they care about serving our country in a variety of different capacities. But a number of them, and I think all of us who work here on Lawfare or contribute in various capacities, have talked to people in this position, are uncertain about entering into public service at this point. You know, going to work for a Trump administration that may not agree with their values and views on a variety of issues, or even if they do, may not be interested in their contributions and their expertise. You've had a really exceptional experience for the last year working in the Trump administration and towards the end of the Obama administration, of course. What is your view and what advice would you give to those people about taking a job in government at this point?
You know, Scott, I think it's a really tough call at this juncture. I think that folks who are in government and particularly in civil service positions should ask themselves sort of precisely some of the questions that you alluded to. You know, is my voice being listened to? Am I having an effect in improving the sort of quality of the decision-making processes in which I'm participating? Do my principals, ALS, seem to be listening to me and taking my input into account? And are they doing so on a principled LED basis? And I think that probably varies from office to office and agency to agency. I think that the most destructive thing that could happen would be for this whole episode in our country's history to deter the most dedicated, principled, insightful people from entering into government jobs, because it's something that, as I kind of witnessed firsthand, folks really do out of a deep sense of commitment to public service, and this country wouldn't operate without them. But I do think that, again, the important thing for each person to ask herself is, you know, where is my greatest value added right now? I think maybe the footnote I'll add, since I am here in the Bay Area, is we've also noticed that this particular moment in time are confronting the really unparalleled reach and influence of social media companies. And I think that the critically important decisions that are going to be made both within those companies and with respect to regulation of those companies is something else that I would really encourage people to try to participate in, to contribute to discussions about, because that is really going to inform really what this country and the world look like in decades and hopefully centuries to come.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Jermaine Kiner, thank you so much for joining us on the Lawfare Podcast today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Scott. Likewise.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet, share, like, or insta yourself listening to the Lawfare Podcast and give it a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to us. As always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.